is being imposed at down for over here. He's going to return us gravitational waves for car CFD.
Okay, thanks very much. So
really thanks for the invitation, for the opportunity to give this talk. So I'll be telling you about gravitational waves via Kerr CFT. And this is work done together with Achilleas Porfiriadis and Andy Strominger. So the motivation for this work comes from two different directions. So one is the line of work that comes from the world of quantum gravity, in which the symmetry structure of near extremal Kerr black holes has been thoroughly understood and motivated a conjecture that a Kerr black hole, and specifically a near extremal Kerr black hole, there it's better understood, is holographically dual, like an ADS CFT, to a 1+1 dimensional conformal field theory. So this is one line of work. Another line of work is that tries to give predictions for gravitational waves emitted from binary systems composed of black holes, say, or other compact objects. And specifically, we'll be interested today in the case of an extreme mass ratio in spiral. So you can think about a compact object of mass mu orbiting a large black hole of mass m, which is a rapidly rotating Kerr black hole. So it's near extremal. And this, so the small object orbits until it gets to the ISCO, it emits gravitational waves, the radius decreases, it reaches the innermost stable circular orbit, or the ISCO, and from there it plunges without any need for radiation reaction anymore, and emits a final burst of gravitational wave. So this burst of gravitational waves, which we now can measure, is what we will, what I will focus on, how to compute using these methods from motivated or inspired by the Kerr CFT correspondence, which was proposed by Guica, Hartmann, Song, and Strominger in 2008. So the point is that these two lines of research are actually studying the same object, a Kerr black hole, like the ones that are believed to be up in the sky. So natural to try to see what lessons we can learn from this nice mathematical understanding of the symmetries of these kind of black holes. What can we learn about realistic signals that can come from such systems? Or to apply, if you want, holography to astrophysics. So a little bit about the Kerr CFT correspondence. So the strongest form of this conjecture is that any Kerr black hole is holographically dual to a 1+1 dimensional CFT. So quantum gravity around this Kerr solution is dual to this conformal field theory. Now, this conjecture passed a few tests, and there were a few nice results obtained by this conjecture. So computation of black hole entropy and holographic computations of scattering of the Kerr geometry, which were understood in the field theory side. So this is nice, but this depends basically only on the symmetries of this of the geometry, symmetries of near extremal Kerr, and the details of the CFT, this putative CFT, are not known. Okay, so everything we actually know comes from the symmetry from the gravity side. Another problem with currently with Kerr CFT is that it's not completely clear whether the boundary conditions used by Guica, Hartmann, Song, and Strominger are astrophysically motivated or are the right boundary conditions. And choosing the right boundary conditions changes what your asymptotic symmetry group is, and therefore it affects whether this can really match to conformal field theory on the boundary side. But what we will use today is a weaker form of the correspondence, which is just a fact that all the physics in this near extreme, in the near horizon region of this kind of near extreme black holes are constrained by this conformal symmetry. So this is just a fact, and it comes from the bulk side. You don't really need the CFT side for anything we will do, but you can think of it as some other way to understand the story I will tell you, or some other intuition, different kind of intuition. So a bit about gravitational waves. So it's really amazing to talk about these things now after they have been measured and observed. After they propagated from Einstein's idea to something that really an observed signal. It took them 100 years, but they did it. And this is really opening a new era of experimental black hole physics, also so-called black hole spectroscopy. And we try to learn things about black holes just from the radiation emitted from them, just like we did in atoms 100 years ago. And the analysis I will show you here is relevant for, not for LIGO, but for the LISA experiment, which I guess now I need to cross the E already now, but I need to update this. Okay, so yeah, so LIGO measured the gravitational we saw, but now this analysis will be relevant for LISA because of the frequency range. So the frequency range is governed by the central big object, and this corresponds to, in our case, to a supermassive black hole, which is not in the LIGO range. So just to summarize the motivation, we want to apply these nice ideas from here to study these realistic scenarios here that allow us to probe experimentally the Kerr black hole. So to sharpen the question even more, we want to ask, what are the observational consequences of this high degree of symmetry in the near horizon region of such near extreme black holes? So there are a few applications. It's not only to gravitational waves. Gravitational waves is one of the applications of the understanding of the symmetry, but this has been applied also to other scenarios which are realistic. So to solve so-called the equations of so-called force-free electrodynamics, the equations that govern the dynamics of a dilute plasma in which the black hole is immersed. This is important to understand the physical scenarios that involve rapidly rotating black holes. And very recently was also applied to study electromagnetic emissions from the vicinity of such rapidly rotating black holes that are relevant for the Event Horizon Telescope, for example. And it will be very interesting to think of more applications. So many processes in astrophysics which are not very well understood are believed to be governed by rapidly rotating black holes. So it's there's a good chance that there are other applications waiting to be understood by these methods. And these are some of the people that contributed to these different applications. So as I said, today we will focus on the following problem and study it in some detail. That will be the gravitational wave emission in the final stages of an extreme mass ratio and spiral, like you saw on the first slide. And we will study this via the conformal symmetry. Okay, so a little bit about Kerr black holes. So this is the Kerr solution, Kerr metric. As you can see, it's quite complicated, but it describes a very simple object. Describes a neutral rotating black hole, which is asymptotically flat, with a mass m and angular momentum j, which we parameterize in this way with this angular momentum parameter a. It has an inner and outer horizons in these values. And importantly, it describes, we think very well, the black holes we see up in the sky. We believe to be up in the sky. And an interesting thing about the Kerr metric is that it has a bound on angular momentum. So you're not allowed to have any angular momentum that you want. Your angular momentum is bounded by this value of the mass squared. We work in relativistic units of g equals c equals 1. And we will be interested in solutions that almost saturate this bound, so rapidly rotating black holes, with almost the maximal amount of angular momentum. So above this value of the angular momentum, you get a naked singularity. So near extremality, we can define now a new small parameter in the problem, which we conveniently defined in this way. It will be small near extremality, near saturation of this bound, and it will be exactly zero at the saturation of the bound for extremal black holes, and we call this parameter delta. It parameterizes how much we deviate from extremality. And we will have in our analysis another small parameter, which we will call epsilon, which will be the distance in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates from the horizon R plus. Okay, so we want to be near the horizon. So this is near horizon parameter, and this is near extremality parameter. And so in a beautiful paper by Bardeen and Horowitz from 99, it was understood what happens when you take these parameters to zero. You take the black hole to be very close to extremality, or actually extremal, and you zoom in on the near horizon region, very close to it. And when you take this limit, you see a non-singular geometry appearing in the near horizon limit, which is called, so in the Bardeen-Horowitz paper, it was called the extreme Kerr throat. We will call it the near horizon extreme Kerr geometry. It's kind of an infinitely stretched throat that describes only the near horizon geometry. So even though in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates it looks like it's of zero size, it's because these coordinates are not really adequate to describe this near horizon region. And you find that you have this infinitely stretched throat here, which is kind of glued along some boundary to the asymptotically flat region outside. And these regions in the extremal limit, they tend to decouple. So, for example, waves propagating in the outside have it's difficult for them to penetrate the near horizon region and vice versa. And this is this near horizon extreme Kerr geometry, this neck geometry describing the near horizon region. And this near horizon geometry has an enhanced isometry group. So the isometries of Kerr are R cross U1. R corresponds to time translations, and U corresponds to rotations in the axial direction. So the neck geometry has an enhanced isometry of SL2R cross U1. So these time translations are enhanced when we take the limit to a full SL2R, which is like the isometry group of ADS2, two-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And you can see here in the expression for the geometry, you can see this ADS2 over here. It's the metric of ADS2 in Poincaré coordinates. And we have another S1, which is fibered upon it in a non-trivial way. And this is true for any polar angle slice, for any theta slice. If you think about fixing theta and ignoring this term, this will be just a constant. So for any fixed theta slice, this will be the geometry, kind of an ADS2 with a circle fibered upon it in a non-trivial way. But that was a bit hasty. It's actually taking this limit is subtle, and this is because we have actually two small parameters. We can take the limit in various different ways. So let's define these small parameters in a better way. So our parameter epsilon is actually parameterizes a one-parameter family of coordinate transformations, from the original Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, which are hatted here, to these near-horizon coordinates, RT and phi. So when we take epsilon to zero, we zoom in on the near-horizon region. But as you see here, we also rescale time, and we also move to a co-rotating frame together with a black hole. So this new axial coordinate is a co-rotating coordinate together with a black hole. And our near extremality parameter as defined as before. So these are the two parameters. Now I can do I can take the limit in two ways which are meaningful. One of them is to take the black hole first to be exactly extremal. So to take a black hole that exactly saturates the extremal bound, and then to zoom in on the near horizon region. This will give us this neck geometry that we discovered by Bardeen and Horowitz. And the other way to take the limit is to take these small parameters to be proportional to each other. And with some constant of proportionality kappa. And when we take the limit in this way, we get this metric, which as you can see is different from that one. Specifically, this parameter kappa will now appear in the metric explicitly. Maybe not very surprising. But this is a well-known story that happens also in two-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And the story is that these two geometry, these two metrics are actually locally, geometrically the same. So they're the same geometry locally, but these coordinates cover different patches of the full geometry. So if this is the near horizon region, which we can think about as this kind of infinite strip in the global coordinates picture, these coordinates cover only what is called a Rindler patch or a finite temperature patch in this near horizon geometry. And these coordinates are like Poincaré coordinates in ADS2. So they cover this kind of triangle in the geometry. But if I sit in a point over here in this, inside this patch, it can be described, the geometry, the local geometry can be described both by this, by the near neck geometry, and by the neck geometry.
Can I ask you?
Yeah.
What is the general diagram for sure? Because it's not spherical, it's not in the geometry. So.
Yeah. By the way, please feel free to ask me anytime any question. Yeah. So there are directions that are suppressed here, right? The theta direction is suppressed, and also the phi direction is suppressed. Kind of like only the TR plane.
Some value of theta.
Some value, some fixed value of theta and phi. Right.
Can I ask a question about the previous
yeah.
So the in curve there are these two Killing vectors that give rise to the R and the U1.
Right.
And then there's this other Killing tensor that gives rise to like the conserved Carter.
It's other Killing vectors. You have
now. That has nothing to do with the enhancement. That's a completely separate thing from the enhancement and symmetry and the near and then growth.
Sorry.
So the extra Killing tensor, the one that gives rise to the Carter
constant. Yeah. No, that's not related. No. It's not related to this. You have this additionally here as well. Yeah. All right. So we will use this fact that these, I can describe actually the local geometry by these two different metrics, but globally they are covering different patches of the full spacetime. All right. Let's start now solving physical problems. So first look at the circular orbit. So we think about the circular orbit in the near horizon region of an extremal Kerr black hole emitting gravitational waves. Okay? In this Penrose diagram picture of this near horizon geometry, by the way, maybe it will help to show you how this is embedded in the full geometry. So let me very quickly, don't look for a second. Okay. So this near horizon geometry, you can think of it as this part of the full Kerr Penrose diagram. Okay, so this near horizon limit gives me this red part here. So this is the strip. Okay, and when I look at the triangular patch, I'm looking, for example, at this patch here. Okay? Good. Back, where am I going? Okay. So now I'm in the near horizon geometry of a rapidly rotating black hole. And it's emitting, I have some compact object orbiting at a fixed radius R0. It's emitting gravitational waves, or if you want, actually you can think of it as just a toy model of emitting scalar waves, a scalar charge star. It doesn't really matter. It's pretty much the same in a scalar, just in a wave equation and linearized Einstein equations. So it will emit these gravitational waves both into the horizon, the future horizon, and up towards the boundary where it needs later to be matched to the full geometry, but this we'll get to in the end. So how can we solve for this scenario? So this is simple, right? Because it's a circular orbit. It has a lot of symmetry. We can actually reduce it to a one-dimensional problem. Just separate the equations. You reduce to a one-dimensional radial problem of finding It's equivalent to the problem of finding the Green's function of this wave equation. So we have some source sitting at a fixed radius R0, and we know the solution on the left is some homogeneous solution, the solution on the right is another homogeneous solution. We need to stitch them over here at the point where the source sits, and we're done. And we even have a great simplification due to the fact that we have this enhanced symmetry in the near horizon region, so these wave functions are actually simpler than, say, in the Schwarzschild case. And this gives us the solution for a certain value of this orbital parameters corresponding exactly to the innermost stable circular orbit. So this will give us this solution for a particle on the innermost stable circular orbit emitting gravitational waves. So this is nice, but now let us consider really the more complicated problem of the plunge. So in the plunge we have less symmetry. The particle is not at the fixed radius anymore. It's now falling into the horizon, starting, for example, at the innermost stable circular orbit here, and plunging into the horizon, emitting gravitational waves. So how can we solve this problem? This looks much harder. But luckily, we have a magic trick here that will help us solve the problem. So it turns out that this problem does have exactly the same amount of symmetry as the former one. And this can be seen by embedding this near-neck patch using a coordinate transformation or a diffeomorphism inside this larger neck patch, in which this orbit, which here appeared as a plunge, now is just a circular orbit we already solved for. So this is kind of gives us automatically the solution also for this plunge in terms of the problem we already solved. So here we're really using the full symmetry to get the solution. And if you want to remember one picture from this whole talk, so I suggest this will be the one because it's really nice. So just to reiterate this again, we have here a complicated orbit in a more complicated geometry, more complicated metric, and we're mapping it to a simple orbit in a simpler metric.
So how would this work? So if I have an orbit that is circular, so the frequency of the radiation would be monochromatic, but if it's plunging, it would
right. So yeah, so you're asking, so what really happens physically, right? Does the particle plunge into the horizon or not? Right, this is, this. Yeah. So this is, if you're looking at the purely near horizon picture, it's the same thing. The only difference is, the only way you can see this is by matching to the outside region. Because in this problem, you need to match to the asymptotically flat outside region this whole boundary. And in this problem, you need to match this part. And this kind of, just the way in which you match the boundary tells you what's really the physical problem you're considering. And it's different physically. It's not the same radiation. But it's controlled only by how you do the matching.
But when... then in some sense, if or it doesn't match in some way, so it's in a circular, wouldn't they have to know the solution in order to do the proper matching? What I'm saying is if I'm thinking of a matching the circular problem into the plunging problem, so the transformation or the matching I do would have to know what the true behavior is.
Right. So what we do actually, from the technical point of view, what we do is solve the problem first without demanding any boundary conditions here, solve it in generality. And then we have this thing that we need to fix, but we fix it only in the end. So we solve the problem in full generality, we do the transformation, it's still solved in generality, but then we decide kind of what's the ratio between the two modes at infinity by propagating the boundary conditions, if you want, from infinity, or in other words, doing a matched asymptotic expansion procedure at the boundary. So, but you delay it to the end, and then you can do first the transformation and then do the matching. Okay, so just to show that I'm not cheating here, these are the equations. So these are the equations of a circular orbit in neck. So you can see that the radius is fixed and the angle evolves linearly with time. And these are the equations of a plunge in near neck. You can see they're much more complicated. And this is the diffeomorphism, or the mapping that maps this patch into a part of this patch. And it takes this orbit into this orbit. Okay, and of course, it takes the near neck metric to the neck metric. And this gives us a very specific plunge in near neck, parameterized by these orbital parameters, energy and angular momentum, from the point of view of the near horizon region. So there's also a CFT interpretation. Let me talk about this briefly. It's not very important. You can do everything just on the gravity side, but there's This is another picture that maybe some people will find intuitive. So this orbital, think about this orbital object in a circular orbit around the black hole. So this is dual to adding, in the CFT side, this is dual to adding an external driving term to the CFT. So coupling a CFT operator to a certain source term. And this source term induces a certain transition rate out of the vacuum state of the CFT. So kind of drives energy into the CFT. And this is dual to the flux that goes down the horizon on the bulk side. So you can do a calculation that that checks if these two quantities really match. And they match. Okay, so the flux on the bulk side, this is for a scalar field, is just defined by this energy flux. You need to integrate it over the horizon. And here on the CFT side, this transition rate is calculated using Fermi's golden rule. And all you need to know about the CFT is this CFT two-point function, which is fixed completely by the symmetry in a 1+1-dimensional CFT. So you find that they really match. This is for the circular case. But now the nice thing comes in the plunge case. So there's also a CFT interpretation for the plunge. And how is this done? So we know that the plunge is gotten from the circular orbit by this conformal mapping. So we can take this conformal mapping to the boundary. We can take the R goes to infinity limit of the conformal mapping and get this transformation on the boundary, which looks just like a time reparametrization on the boundary. Yeah, just reparametrizing time. And this can be interpreted as a conformal transformation because every two-dimensional metrics are related to each other by a conformal transformation. This will be the conformal factor of this transformation, just the derivative of this function here. And we know how to transform objects in the CFT that have a well-defined conformal weight. Here, the conformal weight is 1 minus h. If the h is the conformal weight of the operator O, which is coupled to this j, so we just take the conformal factor to the power of the conformal weight, and we have the new source corresponding to the plunge. It's kind of a very different picture to get the source corresponding to the plunge. And then you can repeat the procedure from earlier and see that you actually get also here that the flux is equal to the transition rate. So this was the CFT story. And now back to the bulk. And now we can, now it's for the realistic context, it's nice that we solve for one plunge, but we can ask now, how can we generalize this? Can we get more orbits by this method? So what are the tools that we have? So we'll consider only equatorial orbits. And what are the tools that we have? We have this operation of this SL2R, and we have this cutting into Riddler wedges that we saw earlier. So it's interesting to explore for a second how these SL2Rs operate on the near horizon geometry. So the SL2R has three generators. It's kind of like the symmetry group of the sphere. It's the symmetry group of the hyperbolic space, two-dimensional. So it has three generators, which are independent. And this is kind of a way to picture how they operate on this near horizon geometry. So one is, so let's start with this, Poincaré time translations. So just these operate on this Poincaré patch or neck patch just by translating time in this direction, which is like tangent to this red line here, to the orbit. So translating everything in the usual manner. But we have also a global time translation, which is translation of global time, of the time in global coordinates. And this kind of shifts everything up and down rigidly, shifts all this triangle up and down. So this is another thing we can do, which is independent of the green one. And another thing we have is dilatation. So it takes So for example, for this orbit, it will take it down towards the horizon or up towards the boundary. So let's see what we can do using these tools. So one thing we can do is already generalize a one parameter family of plunges. So now plunges which have arbitrary energy labeled by this R0 here, but still with the value of angular momentum that we had before. So if you think about it from the transformation point of view, we start with this circular orbit here, and then we perform global time translation, and we get this patch here. And in this patch, this orbit looks like a plunge that starts from the boundary and falls rapidly into the horizon. So again, we have the solution in the larger patch. We can just reduce it to, sorry, to this patch. And then we get the solution for this fast plunge, fast neck plunge. And we can do the same also with near neck. So we can do a combination of cutting into this kind of Rindler wedge or near neck wedge, and then performing a global time translation to get a fast plunge in near neck, which is better actually, because this can be matched also to a near extremal black hole in the outside region. So this will give you a more realistic waveform. Now, can we generalize to any equatorial orbit? This is a natural question. And equatorial orbits are labeled by two parameters. So by now we had only one parameter family of orbits. Now we want to generalize into a two-parameter family of orbits. And this can also be done. And this will appear hopefully in a few days, this paper, where we do this. So you can start now not from this circular orbit in the neck geometry, but you can start with these circular orbits in the near neck geometry, which are actually unstable circular orbits. So they exist between the innermost stable circular orbit and down up to the light ring, down to the light ring. And they have this kind of generic angular momentum, which is described by R0, here the radius of the orbit that we're taking. So now we have a one-parameter family of circular orbits. Now we can use this to transform into a two-parameter family of orbits. Because, okay, the angular momentum is actually fixed by which circular orbit I take. And now we can define a transformation that has another parameter in it, this chi zero, which I will explain in a second, that transforms the energy in this way. So you see this dependence on chi zero here means that I can get any energy that I want. So this gives me a two-parameter family or generic equatorial orbit, if you want. So what's this transformation? Think about it in this way. So I want to study the orbit in this patch down here. So I can do a combination of a global time translation to get to this patch here, where this red orbit here is the circular orbit. And then I can perform another transformation, which is a Poincaré time translation in a larger neck patch. So it kind of shifts the future horizon here up and down. Okay, so this allows me to adjust the energy however that I want. For example, I can get an energy for this orange orbit, which is smaller than the energy of the red orbit, or I can get it higher, like in this green orbit. And in fact, this green orbit is even not a plunging orbit anymore. Because you see that in this patch, the story is that this particle, this compact object enters the near horizon region, stays there for a while, and then goes out again. It doesn't plunge into the future horizon. So this is a way to get this kind of grazing orbits or oscillating orbits that may also be interesting.
So in this, you can play with the time translations. Do you get anything if you play with the rotation?
So you can't get more for equatorial orbits because we basically covered everything already. But it is true that you can get this also in other ways. You can get so we thought about it in this way, but it's very conceivable that you can think about it in a different way. Use a dilatation instead. Yeah. All right. So another nice application, and this is a new application for this story, is to the so-called gravitational self-force. So the gravitational self-force problem is a very challenging one. So what's the gravitational self-force? It's the force that acts on this compact object itself by the energy it produced in the past. It can either be in the very recent past or more far away. And this, okay, so the force on the particle is just the gradient of the field at the location of the particle. Think about the scalar field for now. But this doesn't work for a point particle because the field diverges at the location of the particle. So there's a whole very non-trivial story of how to regularize the field there, how to take just the regular piece of the field that causes the cell force and not how to separate it, how to take this. This is, can be thought of as the Coulombic 1 over r part of the field generated just by a point charge in rest in flat space. So there we know how to do it, but it's much more non-trivial to do it when the particle starts to move and it is in curved space. So there's a full story of how to do this separation and to take this regular piece of the field. And this was done by Detweiler and Whiting. And the main point here is that the Detweiler-Whiting decomposition only depends on the local geometry at the point where the particle is sitting. It doesn't depend on global properties of the space-time. So locally, our transformation is just a diffeomorphism. It doesn't change the geometry. So the decomposition stays the same. That means that the regular part of the field for a circular orbit is still the regular part of the field for a plunge. And then we can just calculate once the cell force for a circular orbit, and then we have automatically the solution for a two-parameter family of orbits around a near extreme curved black hole. So this is, from the cell force point of view, this is a highly non-trivial thing because it's very hard to compute it to compute the cell force for orbits that don't have as much symmetry as, say, a circular orbit. And this is relevant also, there are interesting applications for this, for computing trajectories in the near horizon region of such black holes, and for Gedanken experiments that try to overspin the black hole. So we do cover also these orbits that have the potential to overspin the black hole, to drive it beyond extremality if you neglect back reaction. Okay, this is a new application. And let's discuss briefly the embedding in the Fulker story. So as we saw, this is this near horizon region for a near extremal curved black hole, or for a non-extremal curved black hole in the full Penrose diagram. And what we want to compute is the gravitational waves reaching null infinity, say we're in this patch. And this purple line here is the orbit that we're considering. And these are the gravitational waves. So in our analysis, we analyze only what happens in this near horizon region. And then we need to later match, through a matched asymptotic expansion, to the outside region. So basically, we take the solution here, we expand it near the boundary, and then we take a generic solution here, which is outgoing at infinity, and we expand it near the boundary, and then we match these two solutions. And this gives us a gravitational wave signal at infinity. And as I said, this is done only in the end. So you can solve this problem in generality, leaving the boundary conditions here unfixed, and do this matching only in the end. So gravitational wave signal. Let's see what we can get. So this matching procedure gives you the signal in the frequency domain. Now you can also do this in the time domain. And transforming to the time domain is also a non-trivial task. At late times, the waveform is governed by the singularities in the frequency plane of the Green's function of the solution, the frequency domain solution. And specifically, we'll be interested here in the regime that is controlled by the quasi-normal modes, where they dominate the signal. So these quasi-normal modes of near-extremal curved black hole look like this, where we have the real part, which is basically m, the angular momentum eigenvalue, times the angular frequency of the horizon. And we have another part, the imaginary part, which is small, proportional to this parameter delta, the closeness to extremality. So these are quasi-normal modes that decay very, very slowly, but oscillate approximately at the angular frequency of the horizon. So it turns out that you can compute the amplitudes of these different quasi-normal modes, and even more than that, you can sum over them analytically. You can do the full sum over n, this overtone number, and get the full time domain solution, which looks like this. It has this very, I mean, just showing this in order to show that there's a very non-trivial form of the waveform arising from here. So we see an exponential of this, it's a damped exponential with this frequency times the time. This is already the time in the outside region, the Borel-Lindquist coordinates. So it oscillates approximately at the velocity of the horizon, the angular velocity of the horizon times this little m, and it decays very slowly. But this is not all. We also have this term, which is a modulation on this waveform. So it goes to zero at late times, but it's non-zero at early time. And this approximation all becomes valid from some time on, so we don't have to worry about this 1 over delta here. So this is a non-trivial form of the waveform. And let me just now conclude. So try to show you in some detail here the power of symmetry in this case as a computational tool. So we can get an analytic solution for generic equatorial plunges. We generalize to any angular momentum of the orbit, of equatorial orbit, and we also apply this to the cell force. So, some directions. So, first thing, it will be very interesting to find more astrophysical applications, possibly even ones that are even strongly visible. It will be very interesting to try to understand using these kind of methods astrophysical effects like relativistic jets or the physics of active galactic nuclei. Some theoretical issues that will also be interesting to understand as first to try to settle this debate about the boundary conditions in the neck geometry that were so this was debated in the analysis of Guicke, Hartmann, Tsong, and Strominger, and these boundary conditions are actually not arbitrary to choose. These boundary conditions are inherited from the outside region. So you can propagate the solution from the outside until the boundary. This dictates certain boundary conditions. So it will be interesting to understand what's the asymptotic symmetry group of this near horizon region that's dictated by these boundary conditions. Another issue that will be very interesting to understand is including back reaction into the story. So back reaction, so in all our analysis, we neglected the back reaction on the black hole itself, but it will become important in certain scenarios that are very interesting for the point of view of black hole physics. So for example, for the study of turbulence, the turbulent behavior of black holes, where this comes into play, and for the analysis of, and for the evolution of horizon instabilities or Aretakis instabilities that develop when the black hole is extremal, and then they have a mechanism which was studied numerically in which these instabilities grow, and then by back reaction they drive the black hole off extremality and then they decay. It will be interesting to try to understand this using these methods, maybe perhaps even optimistically solving this analytically, or at least in some simple cases. Thank you.
Prepare some questions. You expect to see something from Pisa.
I think there is an expectation. I think it's not clear whether these final stages, these plunge stages, will be really the stronger part of the signal, because this plunge, which occurs very close to the horizon, is actually suppressed because, as we discussed before, the near horizon region is almost decoupled from the outside. So waves that are emitted by the star are very hard for them. They encounter a big potential barrier, and it's hard for them to get outside to infinity. So maybe with some degree of, I mean, when the accuracy improves, yes, but it won't be the dominant signal. The more strong.
Sagittarius A star is the nearest.
Right.
This spin is expected to be pays about 0.6 on this. Nowhere near extreme. How much do your current results depend on extreme on the spin?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So our results start becoming, well, they start becoming more accurate. It's hard to ask first, how can we estimate this? So for example, if you want to estimate the amplitude of the first quasi-normal mode and to see how this will what's the error in this as a good estimate, so this will start being accurate around the Thorne limit of 0.998. So the limit of spinning of black holes by accretion from a thin accretion disk.
But you can't hear the speed of light.
You're right, right. Yeah, yeah. It's almost extreme.
Are there any such options?
Well, I think that it is believed, although, I mean, maybe by some people, but it's under debate. But I think that it is believed that a significant portion of the black holes in the sky are rapidly rotating to some extent.
Usually not but, beyond the Thorne limit.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So You'd have to explain astrophysically how you would overcome it.
Right. So if you want, yeah.
Astronomers rapid and physicists rapid are differently normal.
Of course. Yeah. So if you want, you can think of this as just, I mean, there may be some mechanism to overspin the black hole beyond the Thorne limit. I don't know what it is. I'm just exploring this possibility because the signals are very distinct. It would be nice to see them. I don't know currently of a mechanism to spin the black hole more than that, but it would be interesting to explore this possibility. So it starts around the Thorne limit, it starts being accurate for the first quasi-normal.
Do you think there's any way of combining the solutions you get with some RG flow to try to then extend it beyond the very, very high speed of the
thing? I don't know. I never thought about this kind of thing, but yeah, that would be very, very interesting. It's usually pretty hard to go beyond the leading order in extremality. It's a very big leap. It's not like just doing the expansion. So.
And related questions, you mentioned all this was for equatorial orbit, but what prevented you from doing any other thing?
So, yeah, we can get some things for non-equatorial orbit. The problem is that the nice thing is that all these symmetry transformations operate in fixed theta slices. So it's the nicest thing is to take an equatorial orbit that it's always the fixed theta slice and then analyze it. But if you take an orbit that goes between different theta slices, then you can't like transform all this orbit at once, and after the transformation it will not remain like one orbit. You can do it for different modes, maybe. You can do something, but it will be less clean, a bit less clean.
This trick that where you leave the matching, the asymptotic matching until the end, does that also work when you feed the cell
forward? Right, yeah, that's a good question. So an important thing is to say that here in the cell force, so here in the cell force case, it's important that the propagator will, what I mean by retarded propagator will stay the retarded propagator also after the transformation. And this is true to leading order in delta. So this, yeah. So actually, the boundary conditions here don't really matter to leading order in delta because of this decoupling. So it's unless I really fine tune the boundary conditions on the outside, something that is not physical, the boundary conditions here are always to leading order in delta. They're always like ADS boundary conditions, just bouncing back the radiation. That's really. Because the part that leaks outside is always small, goes suppressed. So it doesn't matter how much I allow it to be, what's the value. Yeah.
And you said in your talk, to get this enhanced symmetry at the horizon, you have to impose these boundary conditions, so to compute the gravitational waves at asymptotic infinity, and as you said, you just match the solution. Region to the horizon. So do you use these boundary conditions
by some geometry? Yeah. So good question. So what I actually use? What I actually use is only these two things. Okay. So I mean, this can be thought of as some kind of integrating these asymptotic symmetries to some finite value. So usually these asymptotic symmetries are discussed only infinitesimally. And so this may be thought of, I don't know how to do it, but this may be thought of as some finite version of that, like when you integrate one of these asymptotic symmetries. But basically, I just did this. I just used the fact that I can cut this into Rindler wedges. Mm-hmm. And this is something I know I can do. So this is, yeah. But how to get this from the asymptotic symmetries found by GHSS is a non-trivial thing.
Going back to Leighton's question earlier, he asked about
Carter.
I mean, I know that won't correspond to a mesometry here, but is there any sort of remnant?
I think it's, you have the same, I mean, the Killing tensor that you had there, you'll also have in your neck. I mean, maybe it will simplify a bit, but I mean, you still, you inherit that from the full geometry. I mean, well, if you want to solve for non-equatorial orbits, you can use it in the same way, but I don't know of any way this combines to get something larger from that.
One last empirical question. If you have a particle plunging into the black supermassive, so the LIGO, the strain, is about 10 to minus 21, minus 23.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you see a certain frequency around 300 hertz, 500.
Mm-hmm.
So for you, what sort of strain do you expect to get for these? What would you measure? How much do you expect to see gravitational waves?
Well, this really depends on the distance. And I think that, yeah, this really depends on the distance. I can tell you a frequency range, which is expected from this. It's not what you asked for. Which is about maybe 1/10 of a hertz or 1/100 of a hertz, something that's controlled by the supermassive black hole size. It's the frequency, I mean, it's all controlled by the supermassive black hole Langille, right? So, yeah. But regarding strains, I can't tell you a definite number. I think that it's highly dependent on the distance. And I, from what I understand, LISA should see such events from most of the visible universe. So it's... right, but correct me if I'm wrong. I'm.
No, that's one.
Yeah, but I don't recall now the number for the strain.
It's critical question.
But I mean, it is expected to see.
Well, the point is that if nature finds a way to produce this very highly spinning black hole, LISA will see them. I mean, if LISA doesn't see them, they are not there. Okay, just Shahar is here till tomorrow, all the way to the end. So let's thank you again.